ones with hard evidence at their disposal. He was pleased to see their work beginning to confirm what Buddhists already knew, that a well-trained mind is essential for both physical and emotional well-being. "We are not talking about heaven, God, or nirvana here," he said, "but how to build a happier society." So what exactly have scientists proved? Or is it too early to draw any firm conclusions? The best clinical evidence to date, which I described in Chapter 6, supports the efficacy of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, MBCT, for preventing relapse in people with recurrent depression. At the time of writing, the study published in The Lancet in 2015 is the most definitive investigation yet conducted into mindfulness. The randomized controlled trial involving 424 patients that compared MBCT with antidepressants concluded that the program was just as effective as drugs at preventing relapse over a follow-up period of 2 years, and significantly better among those who had experienced the most adversity during their childhood. Investigations into other potential clinical applications are not so far advanced. To date, trials in people with chronic insomnia have produced mixed results, for example, though the most recent research has been promising, suggesting that 6 months after taking a specially tailored mindfulness course, 80% of patients were sleeping better, compared with around 40% in an active control group. Similarly, studies of the efficacy of mindfulness-based therapies for people with bipolar disorder or psychosis are still at a preliminary stage. Neuroscientist Britta Holzl has been closely involved in developing an instructor-led mindfulness program for bipolar disorder. Though major clinical trials on the scale of those for preventing relapse in major depression have yet to be conducted, critics have concerns that in conditions like these, meditation might actually trigger psychosis and other unpleasant experiences. I asked Holzl whether she thought the fears were justified. "I have never seen any major problems like that in our classes," she said. "People can have increased anxiety with the practice, but it's something that we make the topic of the practice a work around. For example, rather than concentrating attention on the breath, we suggest they concentrate on the body, on the feet and legs." In a sense, learning to deal with unsettling emotions such as anxiety as they arise is the whole point of the practice. And in common with other psychotherapies, mindfulness may bring these problems out into the open. It's a bit like extracting grit from a fresh wound. It can be uncomfortable, but is essential to prevent infection and promote healing. In MBCT classes for depression, trained instructors assess every person coming into the 8-week course to establish whether they are ready and to exclude anyone at risk, and during the class, they watch out for any problems and adapt their teaching accordingly, or provide individual help for anyone who is struggling. Meditation centers offering intensive retreats might not be so well prepared to address adverse reactions. Many actively discourage people with a psychiatric diagnosis from taking part, as staff may not be trained to identify problems or know how to respond. The absence of normal social interaction on silent retreats, the hunger caused by the monastic precept of not eating after midday, and the disturbed sleep patterns that can be a consequence of intensive meditation, which promotes wakefulness, may make adverse reactions more likely. Sleep deprivation in particular is a risk factor for psychosis. People who take online mindfulness courses get no one-to-one support, but these generally involve very short bursts of meditation of 5 to 15 minutes, which are unlikely to cause problems. At the time of writing, clinical psychologist Willoughby Britton at Brown Medical School in Providence, Rhode Island, is collecting reports of adverse reactions from a wide range of sources, but has yet to publish her findings. In the meantime, the best advice may be to practice a little and often and get advice from your doctor before going on a meditation retreat or taking a mindfulness course if you have been diagnosed with a psychiatric condition. Despite recent concerns about potential downsides, evidence for the benefits of mindfulness interventions has been growing. In 2015, Dutch and American scientists published a review of evidence from 115 randomized controlled trials involving 8,683 people with a variety of conditions, and concluded that mindfulness could be used as a supplementary treatment to alleviate physical and mental symptoms associated with cancer, cardiovascular disease, chronic pain, depression, and anxiety disorders. None of the evidence was as strong as that reported for depression in The Lancet, because these were studies in which patients taking mindfulness courses were compared with others on waiting lists for the programs or who received treatment as usual, which can amount to very little actual therapy. All medical interventions are boosted to a greater or lesser extent by the placebo effect. The power of belief and expectation to produce real physical and psychological improvements above and beyond any direct benefits from the treatments themselves. This is faith healing in the literal sense of both those words. Conversely, people assigned to a waiting list or treatment as usual may be frustrated that they are not receiving the therapy under investigation, which could actually worsen their condition. Ideally, clinical trials should compare the therapy being studied with an active control group, in which patients receive an equivalent intervention in terms of the time allocated and their expectation of its efficacy. For example, in newer studies, mindfulness courses are sometimes pitted against cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, relaxation training, intensive health education, or an exercise program. In the past, only a minority of mindfulness studies have met this criterion, though it is becoming more widespread. In 2014, Madhav Goyal and his colleagues at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, reviewed 47 randomized controlled investigations of mindfulness interventions that did have active controls, finding evidence that they can improve symptoms of anxiety, depression, and pain. They wrote that the effects on anxiety and depression, while modest, were comparable with what would be expected from the use of an antidepressant in a primary care population, but without the associated toxicities. The evidence for reduced stress and improved quality of life was weaker. There were simply too few high-quality studies with active control groups to draw any firm conclusions. As a result of the placebo effect, trials that compare the effect of a treatment with an active control intervention tend to record smaller improvements than those that compare it to patients on a waiting list or receiving treatment as usual. Designing an active control condition that is equivalent to meditation in terms of patients' expectations of efficacy is challenging, not least because the public profile of mindfulness has been raised so high in recent years. One promising possibility is to compare genuine meditation with sham meditation, in which patients are led to believe that they are going to meditate and then simply told to sit quietly with their eyes closed. In 2010, a study was published that compared the effects on psychological well-being and cardiovascular health of an hour of mindfulness training versus an hour of sham meditation training, each spread over 3 days. None of the 82 undergraduate participants had any prior experience of meditation. The genuine intervention was found to be more effective than the phony one at reducing negative mood, depression, fatigue, confusion, and heart rate. Nevertheless, one could argue that sitting for 20 minutes with your eyes closed without a clue how to stop your mind from wandering all over the place will probably be a dull or even unpleasant experience that is unlikely to inspire confidence. Established gold standard treatments for a particular condition make the best active controls, so the results from a study investigating the efficacy of mindfulness for treating drug addiction are particularly exciting. In Chapter 7, Fire Worshippers, I described a randomized controlled trial that compared mindfulness-based relapse prevention, MBRP, with CBT and the gold standard treatment for recovering addicts, the Alcoholics Narcotics Anonymous 12-step program. A total of 286 people were randomly assigned to one of the three interventions. Both CBT and MBRP proved better than the 12-step program at keeping former addicts clean and sober, with CBT having the edge over mindfulness after 6 months. After a year, however, the people who took the mindfulness program were the least likely of the three groups to have relapsed. They reported significantly fewer days of drug use and significantly decreased heavy drinking. That's terrific news, you may be thinking. But how about benefits for people who haven't been diagnosed with a mental illness or addiction? Will practicing meditation improve their psychological well-being or enhance cognitive function? In this book, I have argued that mental illnesses are extreme manifestations of traits that are our common inheritance as human beings. We are all, to a greater or lesser extent, prone to the effects of hostility, rumination, anxiety, paranoia, and craving. The growing evidence that mindfulness can reduce chronic pain and anxiety, prevent relapse into depression and reduce drug cravings strongly suggests that the practice has potential benefits for everyone. For example, by improving emotional stability and helping us make better choices in our everyday lives. A review published in 2012 by German psychologist Peter Siedlmeier and his colleagues, which focused on 163 studies of the effects of meditation on non-clinical populations, suggested this is indeed the case. It concluded that the strongest benefits were seen in terms of interpersonal relationships, levels of anxiety, neuroticism, and powers of attention. There were smaller gains in intelligence, positive emotions, and general well-being. Once again, the most stringently designed studies that compared meditation with an active control group found smaller effect sizes than studies that use waiting list controls. Nonetheless, the results look promising, and the benefits appear to go beyond the effect of repeatedly evoking the relaxation response, the flip side of the fight-or-flight response, because in the studies reviewed, mindfulness led to bigger effects than standard relaxation training. There seems to be more going on than simply learning how to chill out. So what exactly is going on? In addition to inducing calm, there are four other prime candidates. We have already explored three: a change in perspective on our self, emotion regulation, and metacognition. The third is an improvement in our ability to focus attention and hold it steady. This is a crucial skill for understanding and relating to reality, by avoiding being distracted or fooled by the superficial appearance of things. Buddhists identify delusion as one of three psychological poisons that cause human suffering, the other two being craving and aversion. Everyone can agree that someone who is easily distracted is easily deluded. In fact, if we don't want to be misled, the ability to deploy attention effectively may be more important than intelligence per se, as I will explain shortly. First, take a look at this problem. A bat and ball cost $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Easy, isn't it? There may be a doubt nagging away at the back of your mind. Why did I go to the trouble of posing such a simple challenge? Hold that thought. Many readers will already have realized that the answer is not 10 cents. Some may even have calculated the correct answer, 5 cents. A few seconds spent cross-checking the answer that immediately springs to mind will reveal it to be false, because if the ball costs 10 cents, then the bat must cost $1.10, which makes a total of $1.20. Don't worry if you were fooled, you are in very learned company. When students at three of America's top universities, Harvard, MIT and Princeton, were asked to solve this problem, more than 50% gave the intuitive answer without a second thought. Calculating the correct answer requires a little basic algebra. But the point here is not whether you can do the math, but whether you take the trouble to double-check the solution that pops instantly into your head. It turned out that students who were content with the intuitive answer to the bat and ball test and similar puzzles, without making the effort to check, were more likely to be impulsive, impatient, and hooked on instant gratification. Commenting on this finding, Nobel Prize-winning economist Daniel Kahneman writes in his book Thinking, Fast and Slow, "Many people are overconfident, prone to place too much faith in their intuitions. They apparently find cognitive effort at least mildly unpleasant and avoid it as much as possible. To make rational decisions," he concludes, "you must be skeptical about your intuitions, the quick and dirty shortcuts that often serve us well but also lay us open to all kinds of delusions." Kahneman argues that rationality therefore depends not only on intelligence but also on taking the trouble to pay attention. Does meditation nurture this ability to resist the siren call of intuition? In theory, it can. The focused attention phase of mindfulness meditation involves concentrating on a particular stimulus, such as a fixed point in the environment or the sensation of breathing, to the exclusion of everything else. This not only evokes the relaxation response, but is also theorized to improve one's capacity to give sustained attention to all kinds of everyday tasks. In the open monitoring phase, meditators widen the field of their attention to include any thoughts and sensations that arise in the mind, but without elaborating on them or trying to change them. In time, this may improve their ability to make rational choices by honing their powers of metacognition. The idea is that, in common with learning a physical skill, these mental exercises change the wiring of the brain by encouraging the growth of the requisite connections and neurons, which, over time, makes the practice progressively more automatic and efficient. This is neuroplasticity in action, and we have seen that neuroscientists can now trace its effects in the brains of people who have been meditating for many years. A study found that among experienced meditators who had accumulated an average of 19,000 hours of practice, there was greater activity in a network of regions involved in sustained attention compared with novices. But among age-matched participants who had practiced for an average of 44,000 hours in the preceding decades, there was less activity in these regions than among novices. This is the classic inverted U that neuroscientists see when they trace activity in key regions as people learn new skills. Activity climbs to a peak, then tails off as performance becomes second nature. It's worth noting, however, that 44,000 hours of meditation equates to 6 hours practice every day for 20 years. Fortunately, more modest but attainable improvements in attention can be achieved within months of setting out on the long road to nirvana. One study found that 3 months of intensive meditation training significantly sharpened attentional focus, as measured in a standard test known as the attentional blink task. Another found evidence of improvements in sustained attention, the ability to resist internal and external distractions, after an intensive 3-month retreat, though the jury is still out on whether the standard 8 weeks of an MBSR course is long enough to make a noticeable difference in attention skills. A study published in 2014 found no evidence of improvement after such a short time. A review of all the evidence to date by Alberto Chiesa and his colleagues at the Institute of Psychiatry in Bologna, Italy, led them to conclude that the early phases of mindfulness training, which involve sustained focus on a particular stimulus, strengthen executive attention. This is the ability to manage conflicting demands on one's limited attention resources. Later phases of training over a period of months or years, which involve open monitoring of sensations, feelings, and thoughts as they come and go without getting caught up in them, sharpen a kind of attentiveness called alerting, in which one remains vigilant to unexpected internal and external cues without mentally elaborating on them. Chiesa and his team also found evidence that people had improved working memory after short mindfulness retreats. Working memory operates as an ongoing buffer, allowing you to remember chunks of information, such as a string of random digits, for several seconds. The psychologists report that the magnitude of these improvements increased with greater meditation experience. In addition to promoting mindful attention, other proven effects of meditation that might facilitate better decision-making include improved emotion regulation, less anger or aggression, for example, reduced craving for addictive substances, and more empathy for the feelings of others. This will surely be an important avenue for mindfulness research in future years, with implications that reach far beyond personal well-being into the social and economic realms. Psychologists are only just starting to probe potential links between meditation and rational decision-making, but in principle, by helping people to become more alert and attentive in their everyday lives, meditation could protect them from being fooled or deluded. When I think of the human capacity to root out delusion, I invariably recall my former boss and New Scientist, the late John Liebman. As chief sub-editor of the magazine, seeing through delusion was John's job, and he was frighteningly good at it. He was the scourge of writers and editors who didn't share his attention to detail, which was fueled by intellectual curiosity and gallons of bitter black coffee. Tellingly, in conversation, he was often slow to respond, taking time to think through what he was about to say, rather than blurting out the first thing that came into his head, which is what most of us do much of the time. Daniel Kahneman would have approved. People who didn't know John very well would complete his sentences for him, bringing a slightly pained but resigned expression to his face, but his friends and colleagues would wait patiently until the words came. We knew it would be worth the wait. As a result of his taking the time to think, John always meant what he said and said what he meant. In an argument, infuriatingly, he was usually right. John knew that the mark of a good sub-editor is not intelligence or knowledge, though these help, but an instinct for when something doesn't smell right and a willingness to expend the effort to do something about it. Like Kahneman, John was fascinated by the way errors can hide in plain sight, like a typo in a headline that nobody spots until it is too late. Intrigued, he would print out an offending page and show it to each of us in turn to see whether we could find the mistake. Not to assign blame, but out of curiosity about the mind's blind spots. One afternoon, John was doing the rounds with a printout, not a page from New Scientist, but a mental illusion that would be featured in the magazine the following week. When he finally arrived at my desk, he knelt down, he was a very tall man, and placed the page in front of me. "How many F's are there in this sentence?" he demanded. I looked at him skeptically. "Go on, count them." Finished files are the result of years of scientific study combined with the experience of years. I scanned the sentence and responded confidently, "3. John grinned happily. "Try again." I looked more carefully, but after a few seconds I shook my head. "Still 3. "There are 6, said John, clearly delighted. He explained that native English speakers tend to skip over small common words such as of, barely registering them consciously. Despite my best efforts, I had missed three F's, even after being told there were more hiding in the sentence. 9 years, learning the skills of proofreading and sub-editing under John's watchful eye led to what will probably forever remain my greatest contribution to British journalism. This took place in June 2008, shortly after I joined the science and technology desk of the Guardian newspaper in its tatty former home in Farringdon Road, East London. The team had put together a supplement about a vast machine that had been built in a circular tunnel beneath the border between France and Switzerland. It was called the Large Hadron Collider, and within a few months it would fire its first beam of protons. The LHC was billed as the largest and most complex machine ever built, and one of the most audacious research projects ever undertaken. Everyone now knows that after several years of bashing protons together, the collider would eventually prove the existence of the Higgs boson. Among the contributors to the special supplement were some of the biggest names in physics, including Stephen Hawking and Peter Higgs. After weeks of meticulous editing and checking, it was just hours from going off stone, ready for the printing presses. Some 350,000 copies would be tucked into the newspaper, loaded on trucks and trains, and distributed across the UK. I hadn't been involved up to this point, but as a new member of the team, I was proud to be given the job of reading the final proofs. I remember the introductory page was headlined, "Guardian Takes on the Big Bang Machine." And I noticed that across the top of this page and every other page of the supplement were printed in much smaller letters the words, "The Large Hadron Collider." Most people read too fast to notice such things. Their eyes dart through text, allowing them to consume the information in newspapers, magazines, and books at great speed. But some of us are slow readers and have been able to build careers around this apparent handicap. According to Kahneman, the source of most common delusions, mathematical, textual, social, economic, or political, is rapid, intuitive cognition combined with a failure to deploy the brain's slower, more laborious reality-checking systems. Typos are a trivial example. More seriously, his research has revealed that many of the important decisions we take as we navigate our complicated world are governed by unconscious biases. Some of these are the work of what neuroscientist David Eagleman calls the brain's zombie subsystems, unconscious survival mechanisms that evolve to help us respond quickly in potentially advantageous or dangerous situations. Your zombie subsystems will kick in when you're driving and another road user cuts you off, for example, or when you're at a party and someone accidentally shoves you, sending the contents of your glass flying. They are responsible for all kinds of fears, anxieties, and prejudices, for the ingrained belief that someone physically attractive is more trustworthy, or the intuitive conviction that a child wearing glasses is smarter than her schoolmates. The importance of sharpening our powers of attention is that it might help counter some of the nonsense that our zombie subsystems serve up, rejecting their quick and easy logic. When I interviewed Zindel Sigal, one of the three co-developers of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, he pointed out something that, like many other recent mindfulness converts, I had failed to take on board. "Mindfulness right now is presented as a sort of mental state," he said. "But at its core, it's not about entering a state. It's about the ability to use a certain perspective on your experience that allows you to make better choices. Mindfulness isn't the destination. It's just that when you're mindful, you're able to make decisions that are more healthful, less reactive, more adaptive, more compassionate." So the ultimate goal for someone embarking on mindfulness training must be to become more attentive to reality. This is an open-minded, non-judgmental kind of attention, but attention per se can be nurtured in many different ways. It can be honed during early childhood, simply by giving children the right kinds of games to play. Psychologists at the University of Oregon encouraged 4- and 6-year-olds to play specially designed video games in 5 daily 40-minute sessions. The games required attention and control. One involved using a joystick to move a cartoon cat around the screen to keep it within a shrinking, grassy patch of dry ground and avoid muddy areas. Remarkably, this simple training not only led to sustained improvements in the children's executive attention, but also increased their scores on tests of non-verbal intelligence. More than 100 years ago, the great American psychologist William James wrote, "The faculty of voluntarily bringing back a wandering attention over and over again is the very root of judgment, character, and will. No one is compos sui, master of oneself, if he have it not." An education which should improve this faculty would be the education par excellence. Paying attention to anything that might be construed as boring is not something that children and teenagers are known for, however, and in recent years some of the least attentive are likely to have received a diagnosis of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. In the US, hundreds of thousands of children and adolescents are now medicated as a result. Because mindfulness training explicitly hones the brain's powers of attention, it offers a potential alternative. And there is preliminary evidence from research that it might work in adolescents. The sticking point may be that children now grow up expecting their senses to be continually stimulated with novelties, whereas in meditation, one must learn to be satisfied with a bare minimum of stimulation. As a result of our incessant interaction with multimedia during waking hours, many of us may be suffering from what is jokingly called multitasking addiction disorder, MAD. Our minds have become conditioned to expect a stream of rapidly changing stimuli, and so we get bored and restless in their absence. One purpose of learning to develop attention with uninteresting objects like the breath is to establish that quality of attention and ease with the present moment with an absolute minimum of stimuli, so that you can feel at home in yourself with very little going on. Ajahn Amaro told the audience at that first public mind and life dialogue between scientists and contemplatives at MIT in 2003. "Teenagers need to be playing a video game and listening to the stereo and checking their emails simultaneously, and then they feel good. That takes a lot of hardware to feel at home in life." Ironically, a regime of mindful sensory austerity, by sharpening and automating executive attention, improving alerting and extending working memory, may improve one's ability to switch efficiently between different tasks. What unites tasks that require sustained single-pointed attention is that they enhance our ability to silence the chatter of the brain's default mode network. This may have a more long-term effect that, if proven, would be one of the most surprising and welcome benefits of mindfulness, helping to slow age-related cognitive decline and perhaps even protect against Alzheimer's disease. The first line of evidence in support of this extraordinary possibility is that brain atrophy and deposits of beta amyloid, the protein plaques that are characteristic of the disease, are concentrated in the default mode network, including its principal hub, the posterior cingulate cortex, and the medial temporal lobe, where structures such as the hippocampus create and store long-term memories. In other words, when healthy younger people are not focused on performing an externally directed task, the parts of their brain that become active closely match the areas most vulnerable to the damage associated with Alzheimer's in the elderly. As we have seen, the brain's default or mind-wandering mode of operation is to draw on memories to simulate the past and the future. The second line of evidence is that in mice genetically engineered to develop amyloid plaques, these build up exclusively in areas of high nerve activity. So in theory, any pastime that holds the mind's eye steady and stops attention from wandering, whether it's sport, solving puzzles, math, reading, studying, or the mindful awareness of everyday activities cultivated by meditation, will give the brain's default network a break and make it less likely that amyloid plaques will accumulate. Finally, there is preliminary evidence that meditation can slow or even reverse age-related brain degeneration, helping to maintain the thickness of the cortex and prevent loss of grey matter, nerve cell bodies, and white matter, nerve fibers or axons. The idea that meditation can help prevent Alzheimer's is highly speculative, of course, and the challenges that will be involved in proving or disproving this possibility provide an object lesson in just how tricky medical science can get. We already know that people who spend a lot of time studying in their youth are less likely to get Alzheimer's in old age. Would a youth spent cultivating mindfulness have a similarly protective effect? The obvious place to start looking might be a monastery, where some of the monks and nuns will have been diligently meditating and practicing mindfulness since their teens or early twenties. You could compare them with people outside the monastery walls of similar age, educational qualifications, general health, and so on, a way to see which ones go on to develop dementia in the ensuing decades. The problem is that monastics are unusual in all sorts of ways. The Thai forest monks, for example, are strict vegetarians and never eat after midday. Their lives are almost certainly less stressful than ours. They spend less time sleeping and are not exposed to the torrent of information and entertainment that we take for granted. In addition, they may be exposed to fewer environmental toxins than the average, and they don't smoke or drink. To make epidemiologists' lives even more difficult, monks and nuns probably had an atypical psychological profile even before they embarked on the contemplative life, as it takes a special kind of person to give up voluntarily any prospect of sex, marriage, starting a family, and acquiring all the status symbols and other paraphernalia that the rest of us consider to be so important. All these factors are potential confounding variables that may also affect an individual's risk of developing dementia. So you can appreciate the challenges that will face scientists trying to figure out whether meditation protects people against Alzheimer's. It took 4 decades of intensive, costly medical research to conclude that added sugar in food and drink presents a more serious threat to cardiovascular health than dietary fat. How much harder will it be to prove that regular meditation can shield us from dementia? Even if it were proven that regular meditation protects against age-related cognitive decline and Alzheimer's, not everyone would be willing or able to set aside 20 minutes a day, year in, year out, for the rest of their lives. By the same token, can taking an 8-week mindfulness course provide lasting protection against anxiety and depression if the practice isn't sustained? Popping pills, the mainstay of modern medicine, seems easy by comparison, and formal meditation is just one element of the program. The goal of mindfulness practice is to transform the way one relates to reality from moment to moment throughout the day. An easy fix it ain't. Could going on meditation retreats of the kind provided by monasteries help people maintain their practice? One person who has been doing this for years is Judith Soulsby, a mindfulness trainer at Bangor University who was involved in early research into the efficacy of MBCT. She happened to be on retreat at Amaravati while I was staying there, and Ajahn Amaro recommended I get in touch. When we spoke on the phone a few months later, I asked her whether she thinks an 8-week mindfulness course is enough to turn around somebody's life and provide lasting protection against mental health problems. The way I see the 8-week course is that it's a way of launching people on a particular trajectory, she said. 8 weeks is enough to give people a sense of whether they want to continue, and it gives them the skills so they can. For most, it's actually very difficult to continue without any input. So in Bangor, we run a follow-up group every month, and quite a lot of people come to that who have been on the course. Coming back into a group seems to refresh their practice. Most mindfulness courses are devoid of any religious content, I say. Could Buddhist retreats have a place in sustaining enthusiasm over the long term? She said she had found them very beneficial herself. Going on a retreat each year and teaching and training as I do really keeps me strongly in touch with my practice. The important thing seems to be to continue practicing however people choose to do that. Nevertheless, it takes steely determination to meditate regularly at home without the help of an instructor or a group of like-minded people. Audio recordings of guided meditations can help, but for many the challenges of setting aside even 15 minutes a day to sit still and do nothing, with only their wandering mind for company, may be too great. As it usually does, technology may come to their rescue. The future of meditation may be mind gyms, where members will settle themselves in front of a screen first thing in the morning before work, don an electrode cap, and perform a mental workout. The technology is already being developed. Neuroscientist Judson Brewer and his colleagues at Yale University School of Medicine are working on equipment that could be used at home or your local mind gym to monitor activity in a target area within the brain using EEG, electroencephalography. You can process people's brain activity really quickly now and give them feedback on how they can increase or decrease activity in a particular brain region, Brewer told me. We think of it as a mental mirror. During meditation, the electrode cap will pick up the characteristic brainwave signature of this region and display it on a screen. By looking at your mind in the mirror, you will learn how to enter and remain in an optimum mental state to achieve the best possible effects and see straight away if your thoughts have started to wander. Unlike in a traditional gym, heaving and straining will be discouraged. It will be about dropping into this effortless state where you're just resting in awareness and not doing anything, said Brewer. You're not clenched. You are totally immersed in what's going on and enjoying the ride. Meditation has changed little since the techniques were developed thousands of years ago in ancient India, but technologies like the one being developed by Brewer and his colleagues offer the enticing prospect of making the practices easier to learn and more effective, even entertaining. They also offer mindfulness researchers powerful new tools. Brewer and his team have used real-time feedback from fMRI scans to explore the patterns of brain activity that correspond to subjective experience during meditation. In their experiments, Christian and Buddhist contemplatives lay in the scanner and watched a screen displaying changes in the activity of their posterior cingulate cortex, PCC, from moment to moment as they meditated. They were later able to tell the researchers how different mental states affected the graph at particular moments. For example, when they experienced contentment, undistracted awareness, or effortless doing, the graph showed falling PCC activity, whereas feelings of discontent, distraction, or efforting corresponded to increasing activity. The experienced meditators quickly learned how to control the graph at will using their minds. This new approach, directly linking subjective experience with brain activity in real time, has become possible in recent years with improvements in MRI technology. Future studies may be able to identify the neural signature of thinking styles associated with particular problems, such as rumination in major depression or craving in people addicted to nicotine or other drugs, Clinicians could then develop games or exercises designed to help them recognize and alter these unhealthy mind states. One day we may use technologies like this routinely to optimize meditation practice and fine-tune our minds. What would the Iron Age sage Siddhartha Gautama have made of that? What would he think of the explosion of secular mindfulness? After interviewing the Thai Buddhist monk Ajahn Amaro, I began to suspect he would be a little disappointed. Amaro is pleased to have seen mindfulness take root in mainstream Western medicine and culture over the past decade. But he believes secular mindfulness falls far short of the Buddha's vision for transforming human beings because it lacks major elements of his formula for ending suffering. Only three steps in the Noble Eightfold Path, right effort, mindfulness, and concentration, relate to meditation. But secular mindfulness teachers make no mention of the other five steps, which concern wisdom and ethics. It is as if doctors were to prescribe only one drug of the cocktail of antibiotics needed to cure a patient with TB. Amaro concedes that the decision by Jon Kabat-Zinn, an experienced practitioner of Zen Buddhism, to secularize meditation when he developed MBSR in the 1980s was skillful, allowing it to gain the widest possible acceptance among doctors and the public at that time. But he believes such interventions do patients a disservice by steering clear of any advice about how unethical behavior, such as lying or sexual misconduct, might impact their psychological well-being. "I do feel that something is lost," he says. "In therapy, it is verboten to touch on any criticism of people's conduct." The five steps on the Noble Eightfold Path missing from secular mindfulness are right view and intention, wisdom, plus right speech, right action, and right livelihood, ethical conduct. Amaro is not proposing that secular mindfulness instructors teach the path, let alone stand in judgment over their patients. Rather, he believes they should advise them that certain kinds of behavior are detrimental to psychological well-being, while others are beneficial. Unlike other faiths, Buddhism does not divide behaviors into sins and virtues, but rather skillful and unskillful, judged solely on their psychological effects. There is no sin in Buddhism. Writing in the journal Mindfulness in 2015, he argued that the recommended ethical standards could be couched in terms such as, "Here are some guidelines for behavior and speech that might help you to reduce stress and live more comfortably. If you're interested, you can try them out and see what their effects are." He calls his proposal holistic mindfulness. This would remain devoid of religious content, but he nevertheless suggests as a framework for the guidelines the five precepts that lay followers of Buddhism set as their goal: to abstain from harming living beings, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, and intoxication. I asked Amaro to clarify the connection he is making between unethical behavior and psychological harm. He used the example of lying. "If you tell a lie, you have to remember that you told a lie. You have got to sustain that lie. You have to deal with the negativity that comes at you when they find out that you've lied. You have to deal with the receiving of disrespect from others when they know that you have been lying. That's a tension in your own mind. There's a stress there. You're feeling stressful and alienated and agitated because it's a natural effect of that particular course. If you want to stop feeling that particular kind of stress, then if you don't tell lies in the future, you avoid creating that for yourself. It's not like saying, if you tell a lie, then you're evil and you'll be punished." As a Buddhist monk, he feels no need to consult the great God of data to be confident that such connections exist between ethical behavior and well-being. But he believes science will catch up sooner or later. My prediction is that within a couple of years, ethics is going to be the new discovery in psychiatry, and people will say, wow, how amazing. What you do has an effect on how you feel about yourself. Gasp! What a revelation! But he concedes that ethics will remain delicate territory for many people. If anyone takes up Amoreau's proposal, holistic mindfulness may be difficult to test scientifically. Incorporating ethical guidance into mindfulness interventions might introduce too many variables, making it almost impossible to tease apart their effects on the symptom targeted, such as anxiety, stress, or cognitive reactivity. And some of the precepts, such as honesty or not harming other living beings, might be tricky to measure empirically. The patient would have to test their worth against their own experience, which is the essence of the Buddha's teaching in the Kalama Sutta, but unlikely to appease the god of data. When I interviewed Kabat-Zinn a few months after my stay in Amaravati, I asked him what he made of the abbot's idea of incorporating an ethical element into MBSR. He pointed out that while MBSR instructors don't talk about ethics in the way a monk might in a Buddhist retreat center, they nonetheless operate within the ethical framework provided by the Hippocratic Oath, summarized as, first, do no harm. This is a sacred principle governing the relationship between teacher and student in mainstream mindfulness. He avoids the term secular for reasons I'll explain shortly. So we prefer to embody our ethics rather than talk about it, he said. If you only have 8 weeks with people in a hospital, a clinic, a school or whatever, the presumption of right action or ethical behaviour, I think, is a very good place to start. And if you come across wrong action or behaviour, then that is held mindfully and discussed in appropriate ways. But to lecture on it and have it as a threshold to get in the door could actually alienate more people than it illuminates. He prefers to keep the ethics implicit. His objection to the description of interventions such as MBSR and MBCT as secular is that it conveys the idea that the insights provided by meditation in a clinical context are qualitatively different and somehow less sacred than those acquired in a Buddhist retreat center or monastery. He doesn't recognize any such distinction. We're taking this stuff that came out of the Buddhist tradition, but the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. This was never about an ism like Buddhism or anything like that. It was about a deeper understanding of what it means to be human. He discovered something about wakefulness and the nature of suffering and the nature of reality when you start to cultivate the mind in a certain way. That's universal. Guided meditation. Mindful toast. This toast-based exercise is derived from the raisin meditation that Jon Kabat-Zinn formulated for his mindfulness-based stress reduction MBSR course. But before we tuck in, it's worth remembering that there is more to mindful eating than either raisins or toast. The same principles apply equally to apples, bananas, pies of various sorts, pasta dishes. The overarching objective of all mindfulness meditation is to learn the skill of paying attention to what is happening right here and now, to be fully present during everyday experiences, and extract yourself from the dreamlike stream of cogitation. Toast a piece of bread, and as it's cooking, savour the distinctive aroma of white or brown, ready sliced or crusty, seeded or unseeded. Note any happy mental associations that arise. Spread the toast with butter, marmalade, or whatever takes your fancy, listening to the rasp of the knife and appraising the texture of the toasted bread as you do so. Notice and accept any frustrations as they arise in your mind. Perhaps the butter is straight out of the refrigerator and difficult to spread. Perhaps some sticky marmalade has found its way onto your fingers. When the toast is ready to eat, look at it as if you had never seen a piece of toast before. Notice the fine structure of the bread still visible around the edges where the spread hasn't reached. The difference in colouring and texture compared with the crust. The smoothness or runniness of the butter. The glossiness of the marmalade, its contours on the bread, its colorations and constituents. Maybe there are fine strips or chunks of orange rind, tiny air bubbles, flecks of darker color. None of this is beneath your attention. Sniff the toast and marmalade. Take a bite. Observe how the jaws, tongue and salivary glands immediately go to work of their own accord. Don't try to stop them or slow them down, just note the crunch of each bite and the